The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'm going to share information for you from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, the Harvard Health Letter, and UCLA Health. And I'm going to continue with the special report about transplantation that I started on the last episode because I think it's particularly interesting. Now, to start with, I'm going to talk about kidney transplants. Now, this article comes from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of May 2020. Kidney transplants are the most common of all organ transplants, making up almost 60% of transplants in 2019. They're also the most in demand, with almost 95,000 people on the waiting list for a kidney in January 2020. Your kidneys filter and remove waste and fluid from your body by producing urine. But sometimes they stop working properly, such as chronic kidney disease, and harmful levels of fluid and waste can accumulate. Chronic kidney disease can also be caused by a number of conditions, including diabetes and high blood pressure. With worsening kidney function, you may eventually need dialysis or a kidney transplant to stay alive. This phase is known as end-stage renal disease. Dialysis, a process where waste and extra fluid are removed from the bloodstream using a machine or catheter, is a time-consuming treatment, often requiring multiple hours-long sessions each week. Generally, kidney transplant results in a longer life than can be achieved on dialysis, even for older adults. Getting a transplant before you need dialysis, known as preemptive transplantation, is preferable and can lead to better results than waiting until after starting dialysis. You need only one kidney for your body to properly function, so you can receive a single transplanted kidney from a deceased or living donor. Living donor kidneys are linked to longer lifespans and avoidance of the sometimes year-long waiting list for a kidney from a deceased donor. A living donor kidney tends to last for about 15 to 20 years, compared with 10 to 15 years for a kidney from a deceased donor. Kidneys can be removed from living donors via minimally invasive surgery called a laparoscopic nephrectomy. In this procedure, the surgeon makes a few small incisions in the abdomen and inserts a special camera called a laparoscope to guide the procedure. This technique leads to less pain and a shorter recovery than a traditional open surgery to remove a kidney. In a kidney transplant, your original diseased kidneys are usually left in place, unless they're causing complications. After you're placed under general anesthesia, the surgeon makes an incision and places the new kidney in your lower abdomen, below your existing kidneys. The blood vessels of the new kidney are attached to blood vessels in the lower part of your abdomen. The new kidney's ureter, the tube that connects the kidney to the bladder, is attached to your bladder. Sometimes people will choose to accept a wider range of kidneys in order to more quickly receive a transplant. This could include a marginal organ from an older donor or a less healthy donor with certain health conditions such as hypertension. One study found that for adults over 70, the risk of early death was lower for those who received a marginal kidney compared with those who stayed on dialysis. The kidney allocation system does not cut off adults over a certain age. However, because the waiting time for a deceased donor kidney can be several years, Mayo Clinic experts often encourage adults over 70 to find a living donor. The proportion of transplants given to adults 65 and older has been increasing from only 2% in 1988 to almost 22% of kidney transplants in 2019. From donor to recipient. After an organ donor is declared dead, his or her previous decision to become a donor or consent from surviving family members has been confirmed, the donor's medical details are sent to the United Network for Organ Sharing. United Network for Organ Sharing System ranks possible recipients, and organs are offered to the transplant center for the first candidate on the list. Once an organ is removed, it is usually treated with preservation solution and kept cold while it's transferred to the recipient. Depending on the organ and how the transplant surgery goes, recipients may stay in the intensive care unit for a few days after surgery, then remain in the hospital for 1 to 3 weeks. Now we're going to talk about heart transplantation. Heart transplantation is a treatment option for someone with heart failure that hasn't responded well to other treatments such as medications, procedures, or surgery. Heart failure means your heart muscles don't pump blood well enough to meet your body's needs. Heart failure can be caused by numerous health conditions, such as a congenital heart defect or the weakening of the heart muscle, which is called cardiomyopathy. A number of factors can cause or contribute to cardiomyopathy, including coronary artery disease, viral infections, high blood pressure, or excessive alcohol consumption. If you can't receive a heart transplant right away, there are some stopgap measures while you wait. One is surgically implanted ventricular assist device. This is a mechanical pump that helps move blood from the lower chambers of your heart to the rest of your body. It is most frequently used in the left ventricle. Over the years, VADs, these ventricular assist devices, have become smaller, easier to implant, and more durable. And these devices are sometimes used long-term for those not eligible to receive heart transplants. A total artificial heart, a device that replaces both ventricles of your heart, is another option for those awaiting transplant, but is less common as a VAD is typically sufficient. Should you need a heart transplant, the procedure takes several hours. After you're placed under general anesthesia, the surgeon will access your heart through your chest bone and rib cage. You will be connected to a heart-lung bypass machine, which will keep oxygen-rich blood flowing through your body during the surgery. The diseased heart is removed and the new one sewn into place, reattaching blood vessels to the new heart. The new heart often starts beating unaided when blood flow is restored. Sometimes an electric shock is needed to make the donor heart beat properly. In years past, it was common for adults over 55 to be denied a heart transplant. Today, international guidelines recommend 70 as a soft cutoff age, with the possibility for transplants for those older than 70 in certain cases. In 2019, adults over 65 received 594 heart transplants in the U.S., representing about 70% of all heart transplants. For years, researchers have worked to genetically engineer pigs so that their organs could be transplanted into humans, a phenomenon known as xenotransplantation. In 2018, a pig heart was transplanted into a baboon, which then survived for a record-breaking 6 months. Unfortunately, this option isn't available for clinical use at this time, but many hope that it will be in the future. Another interesting thing is that there are new types of transplants. The list of transplantable organs is expanding. A small number of face transplants have been performed. Uterine transplants to treat a certain type of infertility are also now possible. In January 2020, a woman who had previously received a uterine transplant from a deceased donor delivered a baby boy, the second such birth to occur in the United States. In 2019, Mayo Clinic launched a larynx and trachea transplant program. When the voice box or larynx is removed due to cancer, the person must breathe through an opening in his or her neck and learn to communicate without a voice box. A successful transplant would allow the recipient to breathe through his or her mouth and speak more naturally. Now I'm going to talk about lung transplant. It's difficult for your body to get the oxygen it needs if your lungs are diseased or damaged. And if unhealthy lungs haven't responded well to treatments such as special breathing devices or medications such as steroids, a lung transplant may be necessary. Possible causes of severe lung damage include COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, scarring of the lungs, or pulmonary fibrosis, high blood pressure in the lungs, which is called pulmonary hypertension, and the inherited disease cystic fibrosis. In some cases of severe lung failure where a donor organ is not yet available, an extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, machine may be used to bridge the gap to transplant availability. Blood flows through the machine, where oxygen is added and carbon dioxide is taken out before returning it to the body. ECMO does not treat, heal, or cure disease, but it can be used as a short-term stopgap measure for those awaiting a lung or heart transplant. The transplant procedure can be performed as either a single or double lung transplant. According to the American Society of Transplantation, single lung transplants provide 50 to 90% of normal lung function, while double lung transplants provide 60 to 90%. There's some evidence linking double lung transplants with longer survival, but single lung transplants may allow more candidates to receive a transplant. In a single lung transplant, the remaining diseased lung is left in the body. A double lung transplant may be necessary with diseases like cystic fibrosis, where leaving the diseased lung in place may cause risk to the transplanted lung. Living donor lung transplants, in which two donors each have a section of their lung removed, are possible but are extremely uncommon. General anesthesia is used for the procedure, and you may be placed on a heart-lung bypass machine. Once the diseased lung is removed, the donor lung is connected to the main airway and to blood vessels that lead to your heart. International guidelines have long recommended caution when considering lung transplants for adults over 65, but an increased number of adults in this age group are receiving them. Surgeons performed just 40 lung transplants in adults over 65 in 1999, which was less than 5% of total lung transplants. In 2019, there were 961 lung transplants in this age group, or 35% of all lung transplants that year. However, it's rare to find an adult over 75 who is a suitable candidate for a lung transplant. Clinical experience has shown that this is a higher risk group with unfavorable outcomes. Currently, only about 20% of donor lungs are suitable for transplant, particularly because lungs are more easily damaged than other tissues. One exciting technology that could change this is ex vivo lung perfusion, which is called EVLP. With EVLP, removed donor lungs are placed in specialized chambers. Inside, a protein-rich solution and gases are circulated through the lungs to reduce swelling and remove excess fluid. This technology allows physicians to preserve and restore the functions of some less healthy lungs. It can also help doctors determine if a donor lung will work properly in a recipient. I'm going to plan to get back to the subject of transplantation, but I'm going to go ahead with another article at this time. This is from the Harvard Health Letter, April 2020, and asks the question, should you take a vitamin B12 supplement? You may need a little or a lot of B12, but it's worth investigating. Annie Oakley, the larger-than-life sharpshooter and star of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, was cut down by an invisible foe, a deadly form of anemia caused by a lack of vitamin B12. Back in Annie's day, we didn't know B12 existed or that deficiency could lead to dangerous consequences. For Annie, it was death in 1926. It wasn't until later in the 20th century that scientists discovered B12 and how to use it as a treatment. Today, B12 supplements are available at every drugstore and supermarket. They're promoted for warding off deadly anemia, as well as neuropathy, memory loss, depression, and more. Should you consider taking them? An essential vitamin. B12, also known as cobalamin, is essential for keeping your brain and nerves healthy and for making DNA and red blood cells. B12 also helps lower levels of homocysteine, an amino acid linked to dementia, heart disease, stroke, and osteoporosis. We typically get B12 through diet. Rich sources include beef, liver, clams, poultry, fish, fortified cereals, eggs, cheese, yogurt, milk, and fortified plant milks like soy, almond, or rice milk. For us to digest B12, we first have to shake it loose from these foods. Stomach acid helps us do that. The freed up vitamin then binds to protein called intrinsic factor produced by cells in the stomach lining and makes its way to the small intestine, where it's absorbed into the bloodstream. B12 deficiency. An estimated 3.2% of adults who are 50 and older have very low B12 levels, and up to 20% may have borderline deficiency. Aging is often the cause. We tend to produce less stomach acid as we get older. That makes it harder to extract B12 from food, said Dr. Meyer Stampfer, a professor of epidemiology and nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Other causes of B12 deficiency include taking a heartburn medication that suppresses stomach acid, eating a diet that does not include animal products, weight loss surgery, and autoimmune diseases that attack the stomach lining or gastrointestinal tract. How can you tell if you're low in B12? The first sign of deficiency can be present, but so subtle that they are not recognized, Dr. Stampfer says. For example, you may have muscle weakness that you chalk up to other causes. Symptoms may include balance problems, depression, extreme fatigue or muscle weakness, memory loss or confusion, numbness or tingling in the hands and legs, and anemia. Should you get checked? Checking B12 levels in the blood is not routine, but it may be a good idea in our older years. I usually check patients starting at age 65. After that, I'll check them every 3 or 4 years, said Dr. Susan Salomon, Associate Chief of Gerontology at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Blood tests look for markers of anemia, low levels of B12, and high levels of homocysteine and methylmalonic acid. Methylmalonic acid is the best indicator of deficiency, Dr. Stampfer says. Treating B12 deficiency could be as simple as eating more B12-rich foods or avoiding heartburn medication, or you may need a B12 supplement. I may recommend an over-the-counter B12 pill of 1,000 micrograms daily if B12 is borderline low or MMA is borderline high. After the level's back to normal, I will often decrease the dosage, Dr. Salomon says. If you take a B12 pill, Dr. Stampfer recommends taking the natural form, methylcobalamin, not the synthetic form, cyanocobalamin. Studies suggest cyanocobalamin may impair kidney function in people with borderline kidney problems, so it's better to stay on the safe side, he says. What if you have reduced stomach acid? In supplement form, B12 isn't bound to the food, so you don't need stomach acid to extract it, Dr. Stampfer notes. Annie Oakley suffered from a rare condition called pernicious anemia. In this condition, people don't make enough intrinsic factor and therefore have a great deal of trouble absorbing any B12 from the intestine. For people with this problem, B12 pills may not work and injections of B12 may be required. Is a supplement warranted if you're not deficient? It surely is if you don't eat animal products, Dr. Stampfer says. And it's a good idea for all older individuals. Deficiency can be prevented at a very low cost and low hassle by taking a multiple vitamin with the average daily recommended amount of 2.8 micrograms of B12. Now I'm going to share some news and views from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And this is from April 2020. Blood pressure drugs at bedtime lower heart risks? It's been said that timing is everything, and a new study from Spain indicates that this also applies to taking your blood pressure medications. The study involved more than 19,000, mostly older adults, who were taking one or more blood pressure medications. Half were instructed to take the medication just before going to sleep. The other half were instructed to take their usual blood pressure drugs first thing in the morning. After about 6 years of follow-up, those taking blood pressure drugs before bed had a 66% lower risk of dying of cardiovascular disease, a 34% lower risk of heart attack, and a 42% lower risk of developing heart failure, as well as a 49% lower risk of stroke, as compared with those taking blood pressure in the morning. There was no observed safety difference between the dosing times. Mayo Clinic experts say the current guidelines for taking blood pressure drugs in the United States don't reflect this recent research, and it may take time and additional research before a guideline change is considered. Should you make the switch anyway? It's worth discussing with your doctor or pharmacist. There is a potential for more frequent nighttime urination when taking stronger, faster-acting diuretics like Lasix. Otherwise, there appears to be little, if any, downside to bedtime dosing, and it looks like the upside could be substantial. The next news and view is rethinking 10,000 steps. You know that getting out for a walk or two every day is an important part of a healthy lifestyle, but how many steps do you really need for improved health? The question has come into new focus recently, with research suggesting that 10,000 daily steps, a commonly cited standard, may not be necessary. A study in the August 2019 issue of JAMA, Internal Medicine, found that among older women, those who got 4,400 steps a day had a 41% reduction in death risk over the four-year duration of the study, compared with those who got only 2,700 daily steps. That reduced risk was even greater for those who took 7,500 steps, but largely leveled off above that. Mayo Clinic doctors say the study provides important new evidence that daily walking, even for brief stretches, brings significant health benefits. A good starting point is to find out how many steps a day you walk now as your own baseline. Aim to gradually increase steps to reach one of the benchmarks mentioned above. If you're below 4,400, shoot for that. If you're above 4,400, consider aiming for the new goal of 7,500. You don't need to stop there. Movement is medicine, and there's no downside in getting 10,000 steps every day, or even more. The 10,000 step goal came about largely due to marketing, not medicine. In the 1960s, Japanese walking clubs were increasingly using pedometers made in Japan. The pedometer's nickname was Menpokai, which translates to 10,000 step meter. Measuring time spent exercising is another way to gauge effort. Aim for at least 150 minutes of moderate aerobic activity, such as brisk walking, every week if you're generally fit and have no limiting health conditions. And now I'm going to turn briefly to another article in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter called Advances in Autoimmune Disease. And I'm going to start with a few key highlights. When your immune system is healthy, it works to defend your body against infection and disease. If a foreign substance such as a virus is detected, your immune system produces certain proteins, including antibodies, designed to coordinate the cells of the immune system to destroy the invading threat. But when the immune system malfunctions, immune cells and antibodies may take on different targets, healthy cells and tissues. This results in autoimmune disease. Many types of cells or tissues can be the focus of such attacks, including the joints, nerves, skin, and other organs. And researchers have identified more than 80 autoimmune diseases. They include many well-known conditions such as type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and psoriasis. Recent years have brought about significant advances in how autoimmune disease are understood and treated. Here are some of the highlights. New options for lupus. With systemic lupus, the immune system may attack many body systems, including the joints, skin, kidneys, blood cells, brain, heart, and lungs. The effects of lupus are often widespread in the body, making effective treatment challenging. Several drugs are expected to be filed for Food and Drug Administration approval in 2020 that treat lupus. One is anifrolumab, a new drug for moderate to severe lupus that's shown to improve overall disease activity and skin disease. Another is voclosporin, a drug for lupus-related kidney disease that may achieve complete remission of the disease when combined with standard treatments. Another drug already approved for SLE is belimumab, which is called Benlysta, and it's showing promise in clinical trials for lupus nephritis and is expected to be up for FDA approval later this year. New studies have been shown to find treatments for clearing up psoriasis. Psoriasis is a skin condition thought to be related to an immune system problem. People with milder forms of psoriasis usually manage the condition with topical treatments. However, these options are less effective for those with more severe skin disease or with joints that are also affected by the immune system, psoriatic arthritis. This past decade has marked the development of new forms of psoriasis treatment, novel drugs that target very specific proteins involved in the immune system. Some of these drugs are biologics, which are given intravenously. Others are small molecule inhibitors, which are given orally. These drugs are intended for use when other forms of treatment aren't working, particularly with people who have moderate to severe psoriasis or for those with psoriatic arthritis. Recent studies have shown that newer drugs that target a specific protein called interleukin-23 can also be effective. And we'll go on with this subject on our next program. We've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I sure hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.